Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. This morning, mostly politics, an interview with Rick Perlstein, author of the new book Nixon Land, about the old trickster and the world he helped shape. Before that, a few brief words in the economic news, since the interview takes up much of the hour. Not that there's all that much new to say, it's mostly more the same. The housing market continues to deteriorate. The Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, OFHEO, the body that oversees the giant mortgage repackagers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, puts out a quarterly house price index. It covers only those mortgages which those enterprises can repackage, meaning it excludes subprime and expensive houses. But it is a pretty good measure, if not as good as the Case-Shiller Index that will be reported next week. The OFHEO measure was unchanged for the year ending in the first quarter, or down 3.1% if you adjust for inflation. That's not the worst level in the index's 22-year history, but it's close to it, and this isn't over yet. Sales of existing houses, reports the National Association of Realtors, were off almost 18% for the year ending in April. Not as bad as a few months ago, but that's what passes for good news these days. Deteriorating, but at a slower rate. There are now 11 months' worth of houses for sale on the market at the current sales pace, which is a record. Meanwhile, in the job market, things seem to have stabilized for now at a pretty crummy level, eroding slowly but not collapsing. But things might be worse than they seem. As I pointed out here several times, the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses some statistical estimation methods to come up with its monthly numbers because it can only survey a portion of employers. It adjusts those estimates periodically using records from the unemployment insurance system, which covers about 99% of the employment universe. Most of the time, the initial estimates are pretty close to reality, but they diverge from reality at cyclical turning points when the economy is weakening or strengthening significantly. Earlier this week, we learned from one of these periodic checks that about 500,000 fewer people were employed in the third quarter of last year than we initially thought, and that employment was shrinking slowly rather than expanding slowly last fall. It's quite possible that this divergence has continued through the last 6 months, so again, reality might be worse than the monthly numbers have been reporting. That would help explain why the public mood is so lousy, as shown by a number of economic, political, and cultural polls. But the rest of the world isn't doing so badly. Our economy is doing a lot worse than those of Asia and even Western Europe. Anglo-American pundits never passed up an opportunity to mock old Europe as sclerotic, but now it's the U.S. and Britain that are showing weakness. More on all this in the coming weeks. Okay, let's take a musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Rick Perlstein. The young American, all the way from Washington. Her breadwinner begs up about in Chloe. Live for just these 20 years. Do we have to die for the 50 more? Do you remember your President Nixon? That was David Bowie from 1975 asking a question a year after his resignation. I remember Nixon very well, but Rick Perlstein was only 5 years old when Nixon took his last flight from the White House to San Clemente. Rick is a political historian who is now out with his second book, Nixon Land. His first, Before the Storm, tells the story of the rise of the right culminating in the Goldwater campaign of 1964. They lost, but not for long. Now he continues the story by focusing on the dominant political figure of the late 1960s and early 1970s, Richard Nixon. Rick's thesis is that Nixon and his obsessions have continued to dominate our politics for the last 40 years. As the last line of the book says, we still live in Nixon land. I wasn't completely sure of that before I recorded this interview, and now it turns out that Rick isn't so sure anymore either. Rick Perlstein. Welcome, Rick. We all live in Nixon land, huh?
I'm not sure. I thought so until a couple of weeks ago when there was a special election in Mississippi, and the Republican candidate, of course, threw the kitchen sink at the Democratic candidate, saying he refused to denounce Barack Obama for saying that rural folks cling to guns and God, who denounced the Democratic candidate for not denouncing Barack Obama, for not denouncing the Reverend Wright. And lo and behold, the Democrat won by 8 points. So I have the very bizarre privilege, I think, hopefully, knock wood, of living Adorno's, I think, injunction that the owl of Minerva. No, I think it was it Benjamin?
No, Hegel.
Hegel. Well, you know, I never read Hegel at the U of C. Never got past Aristotle, but the owl of Minerva flies at midnight. I mean, I've been able to conceptualize what the heck characterized the last 40 years or so of American politics, because we're entering this seam in which it's dissolving, or passing into a new era, or maybe not. Check with me in 5 years.
Well, for someone my age, I'm 55, we grew up with Richard Nixon. He was on the TV for 40 years, until he died in 1994. He was a dominant figure, even after he left office in disgrace. Let's go back to the beginning. Nixon got his start in politics in a way that he would reprise many times in the subsequent campaigns, right?
That would be in college, I believe you're referring to, or maybe not.
Well, I was thinking of his first races for Congress, but let's go back to college.
Let's go back to college. I mean, when Richard Nixon was in school, in high school, he worked three times harder than everyone else. Of course, he had two brothers who died, and his mother later said that he worked as if he were replacing three sons in one, right? So he was very smart, and he got a scholarship to the dreaded Harvard. And do you know that he wasn't able to go to Harvard? Because he couldn't afford basically the train ticket between California and Cambridge. So he kind of was stuck at the local school, Whittier. And the first thing he tried to do was join the fraternity, because he was this ambitious kid. There was only one fraternity at Whittier. It's called the Franklins. And he was just, you know, to put it bluntly, this is my kind of AM radio version, he was a nerd. You know, he was lonely, he was awkward, he was graceless, he was ill-spoken. And, of course, the one fraternity wouldn't let him in. So what did he do? Him and his friends put together their own fraternity. And when I say that that really was the foundation of his political career, this fraternity he founded, the Orthogonians, for the uncool kids, I think was kind of the bedrock of his insight that, well, there are a lot more uncool people than cool people. If you really want to go far in politics, this is the constituency you need to court. And, you know, the uncool kids were the ones who were, you know, terrified of communism, while the cool kids were the Alger Hisses, you know, who were, you know, supposedly in bed with the communists. You know, the uncool kids were like, well, what these kids are up to is really interesting. I'm sorry, that was the cool kids. The uncool kids were, you know, what he later called the silent majority. He kept on reprising this theme of basically identifying himself as the person who was going to save you from the striped pants elites who condescend to you, look down their nose to you, and tolerate disorder because they don't care about your values.
And when he first ran for public office later on, he was shameless, right? He is just, as he said, I think later on, to someone, you have no talent for politics because you don't know how to lie. But he had that talent.
That's right. That is from Leonard Garment's memoir. Leonard Garment is not a very politically experienced individual, you might say. He wrote, he did something that's practically forbidden in politics. He wrote an honest memoir. And he quotes him on election night in 1966. He quotes Richard Nixon saying, after Richard Nixon, you know, basically led the Republicans this off-year election triumph. And he took his crew out to dinner, and he told Len Garment, after a great campaign of lying, "You'll never make it in politics, Len. You don't know how to lie." And of course, it wasn't just lying; it was also smearing. I mean, most famously in 1950, he said, "I'm not gonna make this a campaign of smear and innuendo because my opponent is a woman." That was his public statement. Which, of course, is a very telling statement. I mean, if it had been a man, of course, you know, smear all you want. Then, of course, he smeared the heck out of her, and his most famous line was indelible, because it really kind of connected the kind of psychosexual and anti-communist sort of neuroses of the American soul then into one tight bundle. He said that Helen Gahagan Douglas, his opponent, was pink right down to her underpants.
Yeah, well, this is a theme that runs throughout not only Nixon, but the American right, sexual anxiety and sexual repression, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. You know, I can't use the word psychosexual when I go on talk radio, but I'm so glad to be able to go on WBAI and KPFA and use it. You know, I actually one of the funnest things I did when I was kind of preparing for this tour was I went through the book and I counted how many times someone on the right called someone on the left a Nazi, or someone on the left called someone on the right a Nazi. And it was about 20 times each. It was equal score, right? Then I went through and counted how many times someone on the left and called someone on the right, or someone on the right called someone on the left sexually impotent. And it was like six each time. So just, you know, for example, you know, Dean Rusk came to New York in like 1967, and the kids threw paint at his limousine and harassed him, and the cops took them into an alley and beat them up. And one of them said, you know, you pull these kids' pants down, they ain't got no pecker, right? Which is very similar to what Ronald Reagan used to say when he was faced with the signs saying, make love, not war. He would say, well, you guys look like you can't do either. So just the idea of sexual irregularity. Sometimes I thought I was actually writing a book about American sexual neuroses. Everything was sexualized. You know, after the Pentagon protest, a janitor was quoted in Time magazine saying, oh, it was nothing but bras and panties out there. You know, and, you know, by the same token, one of my favorite and craziest things was this leader of the Columbia strike in, of course, April of 1968, who said, well, you girls should just pull your shirts down because the cops won't know what to do because they're such Irish Catholic prudes and they're so sexually screwed up and they get their rocks off every week with a priest. I mean, this fragrant strangeness that seems to kind of crop up for some reason whenever Americans get into the trenches of ideological warfare. I forgot to mention, of course, Strom Thurmond showing the porn movies on the wall of the Senate office. But if you want to know about that, you're going to have to read the book.
Nixon is a very rich candidate for psychobiography. You've indulged in a little bit of that yourself. Give us the sketch of Nixon on the couch.
Yeah, the basic outline. I've been telling people that if you are you and your spouse want to raise a future president of the United States, make sure the mother tells the kid that he can accomplish anything in the world, that he's perfect, that he walks on water, that he was born on the day of an eclipse, which was, of course, something that his mom lied about. He was born like the day after or before eclipse. And make sure that the dad is really distant, really cruel, almost sadistic in his put-downs of the son. And then the kid will be simultaneously convinced that he can accomplish anything and he can't accomplish anything. That neurosis you see in so many powerful men, whether it's Reagan and his alcoholic dad and his kind of very doting mother, whether it's Bill Clinton with this very doting mother and this absent father, absent stepfather, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you put him on the couch, you get that, you get the deaths of the two brothers, and what results is a guy with this absolutely gnawing hole in the right in the middle of his psyche and his soul, such that he tries to fill it with this absolute rage for control and power. And in 1972, which is how the book ends, he ends up winning the biggest landslide in American history. And the fascinating thing to me was learning that the next morning he was disconsolate. He didn't believe he had enough power. He didn't believe he'd even really won. And the next thing he did was he fired his entire cabinet.
Let's come back to 1972 in a bit, but go through the highlights of the Nixon career. The Checkers speech, one of the masterpieces of American political oratory in its way. Give us the background, how that came to be, and then what precisely was so brilliant about it.
Well, it was a masterpiece of American political oratory. There's no question about it, whether you think it was an ethical performance or not. He basically was accused by the New York Post, which, of course, at that time was a very liberal paper. James Wechsler was the editor, of having a secret fund that kept him in kind of a style far beyond his salary, which was the phrase the Post used. And immediately, the kind of Wall Street Republicans around Eisenhower said, we got to get rid of this gutter snipe. He's dragging down the ticket. And basically, Eisenhower, I find this another, while we're on the subject of psychobiography, I found powerful men are really neurotic about firing people. There are all these presidents who refuse to fire people. They try and get them to resign. So basically, Eisenhower left Dick Nixon twisting in the wind and hoped he would kind of resign of his own accord. And the culmination of this was that they bought a half an hour of TV time for him after, I believe it was
Milton Berle, I think.
Milton Berle, yeah. And I Love Lucy was on Mondays, but it was too early for him, and he couldn't prepare. So he got the Tuesday night instead of the Monday night. And he was supposed to basically be a good boy and resign and say, vote for Ike. But I actually find the most admirable quality in Richard Nixon is he really refused to be pushed around by people who considered themselves his social betters, which is what these kind of Wall Street Republicans who are running the Eisenhower campaign claim themselves to be. So what he did instead was he gave this absolutely brilliant speech in which he completely twisted the charge 180 degrees and said, well, they're accusing me of being rich and I'm not rich. So he made that the burden of the argument. And he did it in this very humiliating, soiling way. He always advanced by these slow, soiling humiliations, by kind of prostrating himself before more powerful people, or the American people, if that's what it took. So he basically ran down his finances. He said, I only drive an Oldsmobile, this kind of, you know, very modest car. You know, this is how much money I owe. I have a mortgage. I owe my parents money. I can't imagine admitting on national TV, and by the way, the biggest audience on TV up to that point, that I owed my parents money. How humiliating is that? But then the culmination was two things. First of all, he made this very sentimental, maudlin turn in which he said, oh, and by the way, one of the gifts I got from one of my supporters was a Cocker Spaniel puppy named – and actually, this is one of his lies. He lied compulsively. He said the little girl Trisha named him Checkers. Of course, the fact of the matter is he came with the name Checkers. So there's just like one of the many kind of minor lies that he just – this absolutely pockmarked his career. And he said, next thing you know, they're going to want us to get rid of him. But you know what? I'm going to defy them. We're going to keep him. I don't care what they say. So that drove liberals berserk, this kind of sentimental maudlin turn in the speech. But even more fascinating was he basically was running against Adlai Stevenson, right, who was the son of a rich newspaper publisher, whereas Richard Nixon had kind of come from this grinding kind of lower middle class existence in hardscrabble Southern California. And he said, some people think that only people who have independent wealth should be able to run for office. Well, you know, I don't agree. And I also don't agree that people with independent wealth shouldn't run for office. In fact, I think the son of a millionaire like Adlai Stevenson has a perfect right to run for president. So he completely turned the Democrat into the snob. But then the best line, the absolute kicker was, my wife, Pat, who was, of course, off stage gazing adoringly at him, said, my wife, Pat, doesn't have a mink coat. And that was what we call in today's parlance a dog whistle, because the Truman administration was embroiled in a scandal because Truman's chief of staff, Sherman Adams, had supposedly, allegedly accepted a vicuna coat, a fur coat, in exchange for some sort of favor. And, of course, that was so Nixonian. Because if someone said, well, you were talking about Sherman Adams, you were slandering this man innocent until proven guilty, he could say, I didn't mention Sherman Adams. I said a mink coat. I didn't say anything about a vicuna coat. But then the next line was even better. He said, my wife, Pat, doesn't have a mink coat. She has a respectable Republican cloth coat. And basically, all the liberals in America, all the kind of Adlai Stevenson eggheads watch this and they're like, wow, Nixon is sunk. This is absolutely the most sentimental, maudlin nonsense. Everyone will see through this con job. But lo and behold, like 99.8% of the telegrams that came into the Republican National Committee said, Nixon is great, keep him on the ticket. And one of the best commentaries on it came from a journalist who said something that will become very, very familiar to us in the decades to come, almost a truism, according to the pundits, which is that Nixon has managed to place the burden of Republican-style aloofness, arrogance on the Democrats. He invented the idea that it was the Republicans who were the common people and the Democrats who were the snobs.
I'm speaking with Rick Perlstein, who is the author of Nixon Land, just out from Scribner's. You also mentioned a rhetorical, common rhetorical technique that Nixon used throughout his career of make some sort of gaffe, get your opponent to correct you, fact check you, yeah, and then actually win something out of that. How did that mechanism work?
Very intricately, but he kind of mastered it. It kind of came from his kind of dark Karl Rove-like political Svengali from the 1950s, Murray Chotiner, who actually gave a lecture on how to do it at a 1955 RNC meeting that was leaked to Russell Baker. So you can go into the ProQuest historical newspapers and actually read Murray Chotiner's directions on how to do this. Basically, the old con man's trick is you always give something to the mark. You always make the mark feel like he has one up on you, that he's the one who's the winner, that he's confident. So basically what Nixon would do is he would make some kind of mistake that would make his opponent want to pounce on him and correct his mistake. And he would use his opponent's vituperation to turn himself into a martyr and act like he was being attacked unbidden. And he would kind of erase the stigma of the original sin or alleged sin by, you know, just kind of some kind of non-denial denial or some kind of, red herring claim. And he had this real gift at kind of inspiring the protective love of his listeners who kind of shared his resentment of the social betters who were supposedly attacking him. And he was able to basically always was able to look like he was the modest, blushing innocent being set upon by feral, aggressive opponents. And, you know, he even did that, you know, right to the end, his last speech before, you know, he took the helicopter and returned to San Clemente. He said, well, you know, didn't they really make me do it by, it's a very, you know, I can't even remember it. It's so convoluted. But if you read his final speech, the famous one where he said his mother is a saint, and I actually reprinted this in another book I have coming out later this summer from Princeton University Press, which is a collection of Nixon's speeches and documents, he somehow manages to make himself the victim of Watergate.
Yeah, I want to get to Watergate later on, but we have so much history to cover because he was such a...
But the continuities are great, you know? I mean, it's like from 1946 to even his college career to his first a speech he wrote in 1929 to win an elocution contest in which he said, well, free speech is all great, but, you know, if you use free speech to subvert the good order of society, then you deserve to go to jail. You know, it was just basically all the same game he was running ever since he was a kid.
But now this resentment of elites, metropolitan elites, fancy pants people, this has long standing in American history, doesn't
sure,
it? Nixon
sure.
didn't just invent this, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of my kind of touchstones, my kind of the history writing that I do is Mike Kazin's book, The Populist Persuasion, in which he basically kind of narrates the entirety of American history as basically an attempt to claim the symbols of the people versus the powerful. Franklin Roosevelt was enormously effective at this. He talked about the malefactors of great wealth. But, you know,
despite coming from that milieu himself.
But he had the kind of confidence to do it and wasn't kind of an arrivista or a social climber like a Clinton who would never kind of call out corporate executives as malefactors, right? So, you know, the basic left-wing populist strategy is always to make the elites, the striped pants, people who are out of touch, telling you how to live, economic elites. And Nixon's great innovation, although, that had been done before too, but he had sluiced it through a new matrix of first anti-communism and then kind of anti-hippiedom, was always to basically make the elites these cultural snobs. And that really helps when your campaign is being backed by billionaires and in the interests of billionaires. And, of course, has become quite familiar to us. When I say, you know, we're living in Nixon land still is the last line of the book, I'm basically referring, among other things, to the Republicans' continued skill at turning every liberal into a cultural elitist who is an enemy of the plain people.
All right, let's leap ahead a bit. And in the 50s, that was the time of the American consensus. The New Deal was accepted more or less across the political spectrum. The FDR was still a hero. Then something happened to break apart the consensus. The 60s exploded. And as I recall, Gary Will's explanation was that during the 50s, all the liberals and the intellectuals said, it's just all Eisenhower's fault. And if we get our guy in there, everything will be better. Their guy got in there, and everything was still the same. And so people started thinking, oh, it's the system. What's your theory of why the 60s happened?
Well, I think my one-word all-purpose explanation would be prosperity. I mean, the revolution of rising expectations. What's really fascinating if you look at the sociological and rhetorical continuities really across the political spectrum from, you know, a Bill Ayers and a Bernie Dean Dorn who are saying, you know, we should have
your neighbors, I believe, right?
Yes, they live across the park from me. But I've never met them before, so to preserve my political viability. Whether it's a revolutionary Marxist who's saying, of course we can achieve this new Jerusalem because we're we put a man on the moon and we're the richest society on earth, or whether it's Lyndon Johnson talking about a great society, a society of splendor without squalor or whatever it was he said, or whether it's, you know, basically a Dean Rusk saying we should pour men and materiel into this place, Vietnam, so we can create a Mekong River, a TVA in the Mekong River Delta. This notion that America could accomplish anything, this notion that comes out of World War II and the absolutely unprecedented prosperity of the post-war period and the mass middle class, really kind of midwifes this culture in which anything does indeed seem possible. And the kind of dialectic, if you will, that comes out of that is what Nixon's great advisor Kevin Phillips later called the Toryhood of change. We're very glib about basically the possibility of not really radical social change, but certainly change that seemed radical to kind of ordinary suburban or urban bungalow dwelling bourgeois white folks who basically didn't welcome social changes that ranged from the changing sexual mores to, you know, people of different colors moving into their neighborhood.
Yeah, that angle.
Liberal glibness, you know, really saw liberals kind of blindsided by the backlash once it came.
And then, of course, the Civil Rights Revolution was not taken well by a lot of white society, right?
No. The kind of dramatic high point of the first section of the book, which covers the 1966 elections, in which the Republicans completely erased the deficit caused by the landslide against Goldwater, was completely built upon the fact that Lyndon Johnson and the Liberal Democrats in Congress were backing an open housing title to the latest civil rights bill, basically that would make it illegal to discriminate when you sold your house. So, you know, basically, so the colors could take over your neighborhoods.
And that's when the Republicans started making gains in the South? Was that the election?
Well, of course, they started making gains in the South in 1964, but they just kept on plugging along. And there's a great article that, of all people, David Broder wrote in 1966, in which he said, people say that Richard Nixon can't possibly be the nominee because he doesn't have a geographical base. He's completely been discredited by his two defeats in 1960 and 1962. But guess what? Because of the rules of the Republican Party, the South has this outsized share of the delegates, because those were the only states that the Republicans won in 1964. So they awarded them bonus delegates. And guess what? Richard Nixon is going from southern state to southern state, lining up the loyalties of these very few Republican Southerners. And that's going to be the base in which he's going to pass the magic number and get the nomination.
And he was kind of cautious about being a racist, right? He kind of wanted to have it several ways.
Well, I say that race was the best oiled hinge in the strange contraption that was Richard Nixon's ideological formation. I mean, in the 50s, he was rather friendly with Martin Luther King, actually, and was kind of considered a civil rights, somewhat liberal. In the 1960 platform, he basically succumbed to Rockefeller's pressure to put a civil rights plank in the platform vis-a-vis the conservatives behind Goldwater, who wanted to strike it from the platform. But then by 1964, as the civil rights movement seems to be becoming more militant, he begins basically aping George Wallace's message. The first time you see that is in February of 1964, after there's like a little school strike in Cincinnati. And he talks about how basically the civil rights people are hurting their own cause. That was always, you know, we call them concern trolls now. You know, I really care about their goals, but their methods are really, really obnoxious. So he would always master this insinuating rhetoric. But in 1966, he pulls back from that. In a very interesting strategic decision, he basically decides that if he is going to seem like presidential timber in time for 1968, he has to look like a statesman. So basically, he lets Ronald Reagan and George Wallace do all the kind of race-baiting rhetoric, and that's basically where he starts establishing himself as a foreign policy sage. But then by 1967 and 1968, when he basically has to make the pivot from being a viable candidate to actually clinching the nomination, he goes all in. He goes all in on the law and order rhetoric, and he gives this speech the Friday before the New Hampshire election, which, you know, basically could have been delivered by George Wallace.
We're listening to an interview with Rick Perlstein, author of the book Nixon Land, just out from Scribner's. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, or on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Early in the interview, Rick mentioned Adorno, and even if it was a misattribution of a quote, that's a good excuse as any to listen to this bit of his music. That was one of T.W. Adorno's studies for string quartet, written when the gloomy philosopher, sociologist, cultural critic was just 17 years old, performed by the Leipzig String Quartet. Hard to imagine old Teddy as a teenager, and it's no easier after listening to that. In the first half of the interview, Rick Perlstein mentioned Nixon's farewell speech delivered on the White House lawn as he was about to depart Washington after his resignation in 1974. Let's listen to some excerpts from it. It's a masterpiece of Nixonia, a toxic mix of sentimentality, masculinism, and bombast.
As I pointed out last night, sure, we've done some things wrong in this administration. And the top man always takes the responsibility, and I've never ducked it. But I want to say one thing. No man or no woman came into this administration and left it with more of this world's goods than when he came in. No man or no woman ever profited at the public expense or the public kill. That tells something about you. Mistakes, yes, but for personal gain, never. You did what you believed in, sometimes right, sometimes wrong. And I only wish that I were a wealthy man. Present time, I've got to find a way to pay my taxes. And if I were, I'd like to recompense you for the sacrifices that all of you have made to serve in government. Nobody will ever write a book, probably, about my mother. Well, I guess all of you would say this about your mother. My mother was a saint. And I think of her, two boys dying of tuberculosis, nursing four others, in order that she could take care of my older brother for 3 years in Arizona, and seeing each of them die, and when they died, it was like one of her own. Yes, she will have no books written about her, but she was a saint. Had a little quote in a speech last night from T.R. As you know, I kind of like to read books. I'm not educated, but I do read books. And the TR quote was a pretty good one. There's another one I found as I was reading my last night in the White House. And this quote is about a young man. He was a young lawyer in New York. He'd married a beautiful girl. And they had a lovely daughter. And then suddenly, she died. He thought the life had gone from his life forever. But he went on. And he not only became president, but as an ex-president, he served his country, always in the arena, tempestuous, strong, sometimes wrong, sometimes right. But he was a man. And as I leave, let me say, that's an example I think all of us should remember. We think sometimes when things happen that don't go the right way, we think that when you don't pass the bar exam the first time, I happened to, but I was just lucky. I mean, my writing was so poor, the bar examiner said, we just got to let the guy through. We think that when someone dear to us dies, we think that when we lose an election, we think that when we suffer a defeat, that all is ended. We think, as T.R. said, that the light had left his life forever. Not true. It's only a beginning, always. The young must know it. The old must know it. It must always sustain us. Because the greatness comes not when things go always good for you, but the greatness comes and you're really tested when you take some knocks, some disappointments, when sadness comes. Because only if you've been in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain.
That was a bit of Richard Nixon's farewell speech, August 9th, 1974. A month later, he was pardoned by his successor, Gerald Ford. Okay, now let's listen to the second half of this interview with Rick Perlstein, author of Nixon Land, just out from Scribner's. You mentioned George Wallace. Could you talk a bit more about how he fit into Nixon's strategy and political development?
Good cop, bad cop. George Wallace was the guy in 1968 running for president who would say to a rally at Madison Square Garden with 18,000 screaming fans, we don't have riots in Alabama. We just shoot them through the head. And Richard Nixon could say the same thing in much more polite language. He would say the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. So, Nixon was able to thread the needle between George Wallace's quasi-fascist rhetoric and the reality in the streets, which was, a rising incidence of disorder.
But he also helped bring out that resentment against the city folk and the pointy heads, didn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, Nixon learned a lot of that from him. As did he learn a lot from Ronald Reagan, too. So, they made a pretty good team. And lo and behold, in 1972, they literally teamed up because Richard Nixon appears to have dismissed a indictment against George Wallace's brother. What was his name again? George Wallace's brother, whose name escapes me, in exchange for George Wallace running as a Democrat instead of a third-party candidate so he could divide the Democratic Party. And, of course, one of Kevin Phillips' great insights was if you add up George Wallace's vote and Richard Nixon's vote, it was clearly a conservative landslide, which was the conservative landslide Richard Nixon was able to realize once he got rid of George Wallace in 1972, by turning him into a Democrat.
And how much of this turn was engineered by Kevin Phillips? Did Nixon dream this up himself? Where did this Southern strategy come from exactly?
Well, all due respect to Mr. Phillips, but he basically codified what was probably already happening. He was a relative.
And was Pat Buchanan on the scene yet?
Pat Buchanan, great story. 1966, Pat Buchanan is an editorial writer for the St. Louis Globe Democrat, a very right-wing paper owned by a very right-wing publisher who was one of Nixon's biggest backers. He was busy writing op-eds saying that Martin Luther King was a communist, laundering J. Edgar Hoover's smears. And Nixon shows up, as he often did, at a political event in St. Louis in 1966. And Buchanan goes up to him, bold as brass, this young kid in his 20s, maybe he's 26 or 28, and says, if you're running for president, I want to work for you. Next thing he knows, Buchanan is in Richard Nixon's office, his law office in New York, being interviewed. And Nixon says, you're not as conservative as that William F. Buckley, are you? And Buchanan said, I admire William F. Buckley very much. And just the kind of Nixonian non-denial denial that, in my interpretation, probably really impressed Nixon that this kid had what it took to be a Nixonite. He becomes a very big player in 66, 67, 68. And then later in the White House, he has a fascinatingly powerful role. He's the guy who basically read the newspapers every morning and digested them for the president with annotations about what he should be paying attention to that day. So this kind of very important behind-the-scenes role had Pat Buchanan, getting the president worked up about pornography or the latest radical outrage or whatever it was.
Parenthetically, I've always kind of wondered how these folks took to Buckley. Was he just another kind of striped pants elitist, even if he was more ideologically congenial to him?
Well, you get it at a complicated question. I mean, Richard Nixon, you know, I divide the world that Nixon built into kind of the Franklins and the Orthogonians, you know, kind of the so-called liberal snobs and the so-called salt-of-the-earth conservatives. And Richard Nixon really was neither. He kind of tacked between the two. But what he did do very successfully is kind of make himself the king of the Orthogonians, kind of them but apart from them. And I see William F. Buckley doing the same thing. I mean, if you look at his columns in the National Review, where he'd always kind of take Q&A from his readers about vocabulary, and he would teach them Brobdingnagian vocabulary words and things like that. This kind of idea that he is kind of a mediator between those who aspire to the elite and the elite, while kind of, you know, respecting their resentments of the elite, is, you know, that's another part of the psychobiographical formation I'm writing about here.
Back to the 60s, you point out that Nixon made a career during that decade of calling for quiet or silence. At the same time, he was stoking the fires. There's that story of the girl holding the sign, "Bring Us Together," which is a story in itself. How do we reconcile these contradictions? Is this just Nixon's political mastery at work?
Well, let's tell a story and see what we draw from it. His 1968 campaign, I'll tell two stories. The 1968 campaign, he basically was saying that the liberals have brought the world to chaos and I will restore it to order. And very much it was this unifying rhetoric. His inaugural address was fascinating. The pundits loved it. He said, we all must lower our voices. And even more fascinatingly, he said, I saw a little girl with a sign on the campaign trail that said, Mr. Nixon, bring us together. And it turns out that her original sign said something like, Lyndon Johnson has screwed the pooch or something like that. And she'd lost that and picked up the sign from the ground. So she wasn't as reconciling a symbol as Richard Nixon would have liked. But you know, very shortly after his inauguration in 1969, he gets a memo that says, by the way, this spring there are going to be massive uprisings on the college campuses. And he scrawls in big letters across the face of the memo, "Good." Because, of course, he was courting the very civilizational chaos that he claimed to be transcending in order to achieve what Spiro Agnew later labeled a positive polarization. In other words, dividing the country in half on the bet that basically the conservative half would end up bigger.
Let's get ahead to the 72 election, which, of course, was a major victory for Nixon, a great landslide. But curiously, as you said earlier, he was disappointed. But in the congressional races, the Democrats did reasonably well. Yeah. What does that mean?
Yeah. When Richard Nixon used to, you know, every basically reaction of Richard Nixon to something that goes on in his history, you can trace to some earlier humiliation or resentment. You know, I call him a serial collector of resentments. So he always used to go on the road for Eisenhower and the Republican Party and talk up the Republican congressional candidates. And in 1958, he did that. In 1956, he did that. But both times, Republican congressional candidates just didn't do very well. Right. And in 1972, even though he won the biggest landslide in history on this kind of law and order platform, 60% of the vote, 49 states, his candidates didn't win. And he was desperate to get a controlling majority in the Senate so he could kind of do what he wanted on foreign policy. So he basically considered the 1972 election, which was a double victory. Not only had he, you know, kind of you know, won this great popular and electoral majority, but he also, of course, beaten a criminal conspiracy and covered up, you know, his complicity in the Watergate crimes. He saw it as this crushing defeat.
Well, it really was in a couple of years as he resigned in disgrace.
Maybe a guilty conscience.
But what's your theory of why he bugged the Watergate?
Well, I don't have any particularly, you know, fancy theories. I don't really think you need one. I mean, he bugged reporters. He bugged Henry Kissinger. You know, he of course, you know,
He bugged himself.
He was obsessed with order and control. Basically, this was, you know, I'm pretty well convinced that, you know, this was kind of a rogue team that was kind of tasked with getting political intelligence however they could. And at the first moment in which they bugged the Watergate, people forget, and I think this might be one of those nice little kind of public relations scams that William Safire used to run to try and minimize the importance of Watergate. People say, why did he do it? He was so far ahead of the polls. He beat McGovern by so much. People forget that the first time they tried to bug the Democratic headquarters in the Watergate in May of 1972, the Democrats didn't have a nominee yet. They didn't know whether the nominee was going to be George McGovern, the left-wing candidate, or Hubert Humphrey, the centrist candidate. So he couldn't even really work on strategy for the general election. And the key margin was this was right after George Wallace had been shot. And no one knew whether he was going to stay in the race or get out of the race. No one knew what was going to happen to his delegates. And if I were to, you know, guess, I would say Nixon was absolutely consumed with an obsession to figure out what his strategy for November could be, considering that he had no idea which Democratic Party he was going to face. And of course, they bugged the Watergate, they screwed it up, they rebugged it again in June, and that's when they got caught.
I'm speaking with Rick Perlstein, who is the author of Nixon Land, just out from Scribner's. Let's talk a moment about Richard Nixon's political philosophy, if there was such a thing. Gary Wills called him the last liberal. He believed in equality of opportunity, equality of results. You know, some liberals look at him with nostalgia because he introduced food stamps and gave us the EPA, proposed a guaranteed annual income, all that sort of stuff. On Vietnam, he was for it and against it. He was very flexible on that one. He was a law and order guy, but he seemed at sometimes to be all over the place. Was there a political philosophy at the core of this, or was he just a pure opportunist?
Well, the core was something that he uttered to Len Garment in 1966 when they had this very strange sleepover in a pool house, which you'll have to read the book to find out about. It involves him breaking into a mansion. But anyway, I can't tell you everything. I gotta leave some to the imagination. But basically, he told Leonard Garment that he would do anything to become president except see a shrink. And the reason he said he wanted to become president so badly was to achieve these great things on the international stage. That's what he really cared about. That's what he really was driven by. That's why he wanted the Senate majority. As far as domestic stuff, he had this great line. He said it was basically just building outhouses in Peoria. You know, he didn't care much what happened. Unless, and this is a big unless, this is a huge caveat, it could either unite his side and divide the enemy. Or divide the enemy. I mean, he basically saw domestic politics as a realm for political advantage. And the EPA is a perfect example. He totally snookered posterity by making people think he was this great environmentalist. The EPA basically took all the scattered environmental agencies in the entire federal bureaucracy and put them under one umbrella agency that he controlled. So basically, it was a move to control this political issue that looked to be advancing the polls. But what he didn't do was appropriate new money for the environment. So it was a complete sucker job, and one that I am asked about just about at every stop. Wasn't he a liberal? He started the EPA.
George Will, in his review, said you don't take the ideas of the right seriously enough. How do you plead on that?
Well, the thing that was so fascinating about the George Will review was it kind of proved my point that our political life now is so caught up in these categories of Nixon in the 60s. I mean, he said, I don't take the ideas of the right seriously. He said I was condescending, yet one more condescending liberal. The fascinating thing he did was that, you know, his argument that liberals are naturally condescending all came from examples from my book. I mean, I think I'm a better critic of the stupidity of liberal condescension than he is, you know. But the only thing that conservatives and Republicans know how to say at this late date with their kind of coalition falling apart about liberals is that they're condescending. I mean, it really is this kind of numbing force of habit that really reminds me of the kind of numbing force of habits that was that the liberals were guilty of. In the 70s, when they really weren't visiting their rhetorical appeals, when they really weren't revisiting their policy ideas, and conservatives, far from me, you know, condescending to them or not taking them seriously, brilliantly played to the kind of sclerotic arrogance of liberals in the same way, I think liberals now can take advantage of the fact that people like George Will have no idea what's going on the ground. They are still working off the same stereotypes of our political coalition that made sense in 1972 when you're talking about a true arrogant liberal like John Lindsay. When they try to explain liberals who've done a much better job of speaking American, speaking in the demotic vein, and not condescending to people.
Well, this takes us back to where we started. Are we still living in Nixon land? The House Republicans the other day put out this 7 or 8 point agenda that was going to be their key to revival. And it read like it came out of a time capsule. They're talking about tax cuts and welfare reform. I mean, what's left to reform? Are these the guys actually living in the past? They think that we're still fighting those battles of 68 and 72, but it's looking like 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if I could recommend an article, of George Packer's cover article in the New Yorker, basically divided conservatives and Republicans who are writers and thinkers into two categories. Ones who are just completely repeating the same old tired tropes, like I suppose George Will, and the ones who are trying to think past them in new and interesting ways, one is the guy who reviewed my book in The Atlantic Monthly, Rouse Douthat. But at the same time, it's actually a lot more simple than that. If you look at it structurally, the last 6 years between 2001 and the 2006 election, really, were the first time since the 1920s in which the conservatives and the Republicans controlled all three branches of government. They had their chance to govern, and they failed. I mean, they really did prove P.J. O'Rourke's maxim that Republicans don't believe that government can be effective, and then they get elected to prove it. So lo and behold, it's not all that complicated. For the first time, conservatives got their chance behind the wheel, and they drove us into a ditch.
Yeah, in some ways, it looks like the 60s and 70s in reverse. We have Vietnam, disastrous war, was in many ways a liberal brainchild. And then they crashed on economic troubles in the 70s. Now we have a bad war, the neoconservative brainchild, and economic troubles.
And
polls. And polls that show the public mood to be about as sour as it's been in the history of polling. So is this some sort of watershed we're facing?
Well, the radio listeners can't see, but I'm wearing my leisure suit and bell bottoms. I mean, sometimes it does truly feel like we're living in the 70s again.
And we have stagflation, too.
We have stagflation, too. You can speak to that more eloquently than I can. I've never was a big fan of Arthur Schlesinger, his historian, but he did talk about cycles of American history, which I was always kind of very cynical about. I believe, men make their own history, not according to conditions of their own making. But, we just seem to be kind of cycling through these periods of dynamism and sclerosis. Only the dynamism now seems to be on the left, where the dynamism was once on the right. And I guess Doug Henwood was always where the action was, because when he was in college, he was on the right.
Well, that's maybe I'm a long, long, long leading indicator of American politics. Is McCain going to run this kind of 72 campaign all over again? And will it work, do you suppose?
Yeah, well, my boss, Bob Borisage, at Campaign for America's Future, where I'm a senior fellow, really loves this speech that he gave a couple of months ago, or this commercial that he cut, in which he said he was going to be the American president for Americans. So he does kind of seem to be recycling these kind of tropes of cultural grievance and patriotism. Whether it can work is an open question. I mean, I think that this special election in Mississippi, that the Democrat won by 8 points, even though the Republicans, tried to run against the Democratic hippies, that may well be a leading indicator. But I don't even really know how else he would run, because there's really no other rhetorical foundation for the Republicans to base their appeal on. They're really in a period of exhaustion.
But the last time we faced one of these periods of exhaustion, or was it the Soviets called the period of stagnation, the Brezhnev years, the right was really energetic and waiting in the wings with an agenda. They had, Heritage had those telephone book style briefing books ready for Reagan when he took office. Is there anything comparable waiting now?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can argue with the ideology. You can say, well, these guys are, kind of Clinton centrist. But, Center for American Progress comes out with telephone books, too. Campaign for America's Future. We, have our, smaller versions of the telephone books. But, basically one sort of dominant keynote of American liberalism is it is a pragmatic tradition. And it isn't this kind of tradition where you say, this is what we're going to do and stick to no matter what, you know, like the kind of partisan Marxist tradition. I mean, it really, hopefully, smart people, disinterested administrators, people of intelligence, public spirit, you know, can respond to conditions on the ground and come up with good, sensible legislation. And, you know, this idea that we somehow need this kind of grand blueprint seems to be more their game than our game.
And that was Rick Perlstein, author of Nixon Land, an examination of that tortured man in his tortured times, just out from Scribner's. I'm not so sure that Rick is right, that a bunch of disinterested liberal technocrats with their briefing books can make the kind of political transformation in the coming years that the right managed over the previous 30. Liberals need radicals, or no one will take them seriously. One reason the New Deal happened was that the elite was afraid of communists and labor radicals. We don't have anything like that now. Maybe, should the Dems win in the fall, the subsequent disillusionment with how mediocre they'll be will produce the necessary mobilization. We'll see. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with a taste of Charlie Daniels' song, What This World Needs Is a Few More Rednecks, a catchy and elegant distillation of the toxic Nixon-Wallace worldview. Till next week, bye.
Rich, what most people call a redneck, he ain't nothing but a working man. And he makes his living by the sweat of his brow and the calluses on his hands. Now you intellectuals may not like it, but there ain't nothing you can do. Cause there's a whole lot more of us common folks than there ever will be of you. What this world needs is a few more rednecks, so people ain't afraid to take a stand. What this world needs is a little more respect for the Lord and the law and the working man. We can use a little peace and satisfaction, so good people up front talking a little more action, and a few more rednecks is what we need. That's what we need. And a few more rednecks.